Let me just say that the stuff that we've talked about till now is pretty much introductory. And the whole idea, the whole goal, is to talk about what is the reason we do biblical theology, and especially why do Old Testament theology. You already have systematic theology. You can wait a minute, Rain. you can do Old Testament theology, or rather systematic theology, which has been around for centuries. Back in the 1200s, Thomas Aquinas was one of the early real systematic theologians of the church. And at that time, of course, there was a much closer attempt to stay close to the Bible as the source, but at the same time, Aquinas mixed in various elements of church tradition, which did not always match what was in the Bible. So even then, at an early date of, you might say, a high point in systematic theology, there were problems that were introduced into systematic theology interpretation. And in later centuries, this simply would become more and more of a problem as the church moved oftentimes farther and farther away from the biblical concept and more into its own sort of interpretation. So what I want to do now is to talk about the development of biblical theology briefly from systematic theology, because systematic theology until about 200 years ago was more or less the only formal theology that you would find. And then about 200 years ago, there was the beginning of a very liberal kind of tendency that occurred within the churches. And this liberal kind of a tendency within the churches began to introduce new concepts, not necessarily always concepts that helped reinforce the authority and the understanding of the Bible, even though in theory the idea was that these would help reinforce that. So prior to about 200 years ago, essentially theology was, first of all, as I said, all systematic theology. And the goal was an attempt, based on the Bible, to understand what the Bible teaches about God and faith and these sorts of things. But what happened was that because it got incorporated with church tradition, it became a very rigid system. And that distorted the Bible in many, many different ways. And this rigid system is something that you see in the Roman Catholic Church of the late Middle Ages. Because people were, in a sense, almost enslaved to the leadership of the Roman Catholic Church. There were points in time, for instance, when the local parish priest did not actually write sermons. They were simply given sermons that had been preached by bishops, and they stood up and read those sermons to the people in their parishes. And beyond that, their main responsibility was to teach people to know the Lord's Prayer and to know a couple of other things, the Ten Commandments perhaps, and so on. And that was mostly the activity of the local church clergy in the late Middle Ages. Meanwhile, the church had become very self-absorbed in such things as raising money and political interaction with the authorities in the political authorities in the different areas where the church was found. And all of this brought Christianity in many ways, at least organized Christianity, to a very low point. And it was during that period of time that the Reformation broke out. The Reformation involved such people as Martin Luther and John Calvin, and during this period of time, there was a very strong emphasis on strictly the use of the Scripture. And if it was not in the Scripture, we don't talk about it, we don't look at it, or anything like that. But this led to a very rigid kind of system of church interpretation. And one of the most rigid of these is what is known as the Tulip Calvinist. Concept, which you may never have heard, but TULIP is an acronym. T means humans are totally deprived. Let's see, P means the perseverance of the saints. And each one of these letters has a particular meaning. In the case of the Tulip Calvinists, if you do not believe exactly these concepts, you are not truly a believer. I had a kind of an interesting conversation one day years and years ago when I was a young Christian with a fellow who was from a Reformed church that was very, very, very strongly Tulip Calvinist. And at lunchtime, sometimes we would sit and we would talk about the Christian faith and our ideas of the Christian faith. And one day we started talking about these ideas. And I told him, no, I don't believe those things. And he got upset and he began trying to insist to me that each one of these was exactly like what you see in the Bible, and because it was exactly what you see in the Bible, you must believe it or you can't really be a believer. And I just simply sat there and told him, no, I don't agree. Before we were eating lunch, so it was an hour for lunch, and before the hour was up, he was sitting here like this, and he got up and he said, you're a heretic. And he just stomped out like that. And that was actually the last time that he and I ever had lunch together. Well, this is the kind of thing that was happening during some of the Reformation and afterward. By the way, even two centuries later, when John Wesley's revival broke out in England, there were a lot of Tulip Calvinists in England. And Wesley had a lot of interaction with these people, and most of it was not very happy, because those who believed this were totally committed to these ideas, and would not bend even a little bit. Now, in fairness to Wesley and Calvin, I think Wesley and Calvin were actually saying the same thing. But Calvin was saying it in a 15th century world, or a 16th century world. Wesley was saying it in an 18th century world. But don't ever say that to a tulip Calvinist, because they will tell you, you're a heretic. But this is the problem. Those who were influenced by the Reformation, some went on to develop a very heart-based religion. But others, instead of developing a heart-based religion, they instead developed a very lifeless, rigid concept of Christianity, which was based strictly on right beliefs. And if you did not believe right, not only were you wrong, but you could not be Christian, and you were probably a heretic. Well, this led ultimately to the emergence of a new effort to understand the Bible. And that new effort to understand the Bible is the one that is referred to as higher criticism, or the historical critical school of biblical interpretation. The idea of the historical critical school of interpretation was to try to go back and do a historical study, mostly of the history of Israel in the Old Testament period. Now, had they had the tools that exist today, the result may have been very, very different. But the historical critical method basically began looking at other ancient religions, such as that of the Egyptians, the Canaanites, the Persians, possibly even the Babylonians, to try to understand the Bible. And when they did, they developed some interpretations of the Bible which were very distant from the Bible as we think of it in our own lives and in our own interpretation. One of the reasons for this was what we know today, the wrong assumption that Moses could not possibly have written the first five books of the Bible. Now, in Deuteronomy, it is actually said that Moses wrote those books. Now, except for the possibility that Joshua may have added a couple of chapters at the end telling about Moses' death, the rest of it, today, very conceivably, we know, could have been written by Moses. But 200 years ago, there was no evidence of writing prior to about maybe 500 BC. And so the assumption was made by the historical critical school that Moses could not possibly have written the Bible because he lived about 800 years before writing was ever invented. Today, we know that the earliest forms of writing go back at least 2,200 years before Moses, and having been raised as the son of a Pharaoh, he would have certainly been trained not only in multiple languages, but in writing, and probably could have written the Bible in at least, or the first five books of the Bible, probably could have written them in at least two or three different languages and scripts, because he was part of the very educated high elite of Egypt. Now, a routine, ordinary Egyptian could not do that, but Moses was not a routine, ordinary Egyptian. He was part of Pharaoh's family, the ruling class of Egypt. And he would have known these things. But based on these kinds of assumptions, the higher critical school sought then to develop their own kinds of understanding of how the Bible came to exist. And they tried to do it by taking from within the text of the Bible certain critical structures that would identify this part of the text as from this period, and this part of the text is from this period, and so on like that. And so they came up with an idea which is well known today. It's called the JEDP theory. J is where one of the personal names of God is used. E refers to a different name for God that is used. D refers to a particular conceptual way of understanding called the Deuteronomist approach. And P refers to the priests. And essentially, what the higher critical school did was to attempt, through various analytical tools, to subdivide the Old Testament, especially the historical books of the Old Testament, into pieces. Some pieces were written by J, some pieces by E, some by D, and some by P. Well, how did you get them all together? Well, they theorized that during the Babylonian captivity, some group of scholars took these four different pieces and merged them all together to give you the historical books that exist in the Old Testament today. The problem with this theory is that there is really no basis to actually support this theory other than their own self-developed analytical tools. And it makes certain presumptions along the way. So, for instance, it presumes that never would you have someone use both the Yahweh name for God and the Elohim reference for God in the same text, the same writing by the same author. And it supposes that, for instance, the things that the priests were particularly interested in would not be the same things as the interest of the person or persons who wrote the J and the E parts. And that, in fact, it presupposes that the J part and the E part and the D part and the P part were not one individual person each, but rather groups of people who added more and more into these things. And so, one additional piece was to support all of this theory, there was the idea that, in fact, since no writing occurred before the exile, that means everything in Israel's history had to be kept as oral tradition. And because it was oral tradition, that meant that it could easily change. Well, all of the bases for the whole higher critical approach today have pretty much collapsed. Now, there is a huge number of Old and New Testament scholars who still believe in the higher critical approach, which is kind of unfortunate. But today we know, for instance, that Moses, yes, could have written the first five books, and he would have had no trouble doing that. We know that everything in terms of actual historical events, maybe I should not say everything, but a large part of all of the historical events from King David on are in fact genuinely historical. The places and the events and things like that, because archaeology has in fact found the evidence of this. We know that all of these question marks that led to presuppositions by the higher critical school just don't work. For instance, the idea that oral tradition would change. Anthropologists today who have studied oral tradition have seen that, in fact, oral tradition among people who do not have a written culture instead is one of the highest skilled forms of art known. And what will happen is, in a culture where they do not have a written language but simply oral tradition, the traditions are memorized, and people will go from village to village or even town, and they will recite the traditions, and the whole town or the whole village will come to listen. But the whole town and village knows the traditions word for word too. And if that person would dare change even one word of the oral tradition, they would probably be lucky to escape without injury, because it is that important to the people whose background is preserved in oral tradition to make sure that it is exactly, faithfully, accurately preserved. And so, instead of oral traditions being easily changed over the centuries, in fact, anthropologists have found that oral traditions will remain unchanged for 1,000 years and more. And so the idea that the concepts or the accounts of the Israelites having been preserved as oral tradition could be changed and so on just does not work with those in the higher critical school. But this was the first attempt to try to develop some sort of a Bible-based understanding of God and his interaction with man in response to systematic theology. It was not yet biblical theology. It was simply an historical study. But that was the goal, was to try to understand the Bible based on the history that was in the Bible. But it got diverted into human analytical processes instead. Well, to kind of compensate for that, in the late 1800s, there began a new approach to trying to understand the Bible. And this approach was what was known as the Religionsgeschichte school, which is that's German. It's translated as the history of religions or religious history school. And its focus, instead of being on history as such, was a focus on comparative religions. So it was trying to understand the religion of the Bible based on other religions, especially other ancient religions. The most serious immediate problem with this particular school was that the religion that we know the most about, and that they knew the most about then, was in fact the Israelite or Jewish religion. So they were trying to explain Israelite religion on the basis of religions that they knew even less about. And this was the concept of the Religionsgeschichte approach. And these two different approaches, right here, the historical critical and the Religionsgeschichte approaches, more or less destroyed interest in biblical theology until about 80 years ago, or maybe 70 years ago. And about 70 or 80 years ago, there began to be a revived interest in trying to understand the Old Testament on the part of some New Testament scholars. The problem was that they attempted to simply use the New Testament as a basis for understanding the Old Testament. So you take the New Testament and you pick out of the Old Testament the pieces that seem to you to give you more understanding of the New Testament. And the rest of it, you just kind of leave alone. Well, this led to even more confusion in the area of Old Testament theology. And so, actually, until just the last few years, Old Testament theology has been more or less a very sort of confused area of study, which should make you feel really good now, because you sat with me for almost 3 hours, three sessions, and at the end of session three, I'm telling you, well, Old Testament theology is so confused it doesn't know what it's doing. Well, it's not really that bad. But Old Testament theology is still something that is struggling to find a place in understanding and interpreting the Bible. Partly because of the background that is associated with it here and the struggle with systematic theology. But I think after this course is over, you will agree with me that not only is there a place for Old Testament theology, but that it is actually a really valuable area of study. And that's what we are going to be focusing on as we go through the rest of this course. So, what is our goal in Old Testament theology? Fundamentally, it is to understand the nature and character of God, which is revealed in the Old Testament. And we are going to have a particular organizing principle that serves to link all of the biblical material together. And this is one of the places where Old Testament theology, quite frankly, has struggled. Some have tried in the early approaches to link the Old Testament texts together based on the history. God reveals himself in history. So let's use the history and let's try to understand the history. Except that led to the historical critical distortions. And in some ways to the Religionsgeschichte distortions. Another way is what could be called the divine approach to the Old Testament and Old Testament theology, which is to say to look at God's character, God's truth, and God's acts or actions. Good, but it does not complete everything. Redemption is another way some people have attempted to approach Old Testament theology. Redemption would then mean something like God's search for humans and the resulting relationship with them. Good, but it doesn't really focus on God. It focuses on that human-divine interaction primarily. Another approach is the biblical approach, which is to say, use the Bible, period. Let the Bible interpret the Bible and use only the Bible. Again, one of the problems with that is that there is so much context that is missing today. It was there when the people wrote the Bible, but there is so much context missing today that it is easy to distort and miss different things by simply trying to use the Bible to interpret the Bible and to avoid use of anything else. So what we will do is we will use a theme called Emmanuel. As an organizing principle for our approach to Old Testament theology. If you remember, God said with regard to Jesus that he would be called Emmanuel. Now, if you know Hebrew, are you all Hebrew scholars? Did you study Hebrew? Okay, if you know Hebrew, then Im, Manu, and El are two different words put together. And im, manu, means with us, and el means God. And so the idea is God with us, or God is with us, or God is among us. And this is going to be the kind of organizing principle that we will use in this course to look at Old Testament theology, which is to say we need to start, if we're going to talk about God being with us, we need to start by talking about such things as God and what God reveals to us of himself in the Old Testament. Then we need to start looking at different aspects of the human-divine relationship. Well, there's all kinds of different directions to go when we look at that. So we might look at the concept of grace and redemption. We might look at the concept of covenant, of the messianic hope, the concept of sin, reconciliation, eternity, ethics, human responsibility, piety, and the list could go on and on. Which is why I said at the beginning, this course will not be an exhaustive study of Old Testament theology because it would be too long and too difficult to do an exhaustive study. So we will look at some of the main topics and some of the main points in terms of the Old Testament and some of these different themes that relate to Immanuel. One of the things that has to be brought into play in doing this is an understanding of the role of history and the idea that there is a context to the Old Testament, and one that we do not know today. You can read the stories, for instance, of the Exodus and the Israelites in the wilderness. You can read about the settlement. You can read about David. You can read about Solomon and the expansion and contraction that went on during the centuries after Solomon and before the Babylonian captivity. And you can read about some of the other things that took place during and after the Babylonian captivity. But these did not happen in isolation from the rest of the world. So, for instance, at one point, I think it's Isaiah walks into King Hezekiah's chamber after Hezekiah has spoken with an emissary from the Babylonians. Now, in that interchange between Hezekiah and the Babylonians, he had struck the floor, I think it was 3 times, with arrows. And Isaiah asks Hezekiah, who was that guy that just left? And Hezekiah says he was the Babylonian emissary, and we were talking about the situation with the kingdom of Assyria. And he tells Isaiah what he did, and Isaiah said, you should have struck it with the arrow 6 or 7 times, because the fact that you did it in such a weak manner says that in time Israel is going to fall to her enemies. And in fact, if you go back and you look at the history outside of the Bible at this time, you learn that the Assyrians were the world power of that day. And the Babylonians were simply a people in what is today southern Iraq, dominated by the Assyrians. But the Babylonians wanted to be what the Assyrians were. And Hezekiah was feeling the world situation, the international situation, and the pressure of the Assyrians, and he was meeting with the Babylonians to try to make an agreement with them toward overcoming the Assyrians. What would eventually happen is that in fact the Assyrians would attack Hezekiah. The Babylonians would not even raise one finger to help. And then after that, the Assyrians would have to pull back, but eventually the Babylonians would take over the kingdom of Assyria, and the Babylonians would actually be the ones who would attack the Israelites, destroy the city of Jerusalem, and take the people of Jerusalem and Judah into captivity into Babylon. And so the fact that Hezekiah had given a weak kind of a response to this situation simply said that Israel lacked the kind of internal commitment to prevail. And even though it was two centuries before all of this would happen, eventually all of this is exactly what unfolded. And that's kind of the background behind that particular event. Understanding the history outside oftentimes helps immensely in understanding what you're reading in the Old Testament. Not creating a history that's not there, but simply understanding the historical context that is there. And so from time to time, we will bring these sorts of things into our study as well.